Hi, I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, the new generation of smartphone apps can provide you with a wide range of health-related information, such as counting your steps, measuring distance walked, and figuring out your heart rate. Now, the latest app can also help you manage your menopausal symptoms. A women's health expert from Harvard Medical School explains.
But first, a 3-degree drop in temperature is barely noticeable if you're talking about the weather outside. But in the human body, a 3-degree drop from the normal 98.6-degree core temperature puts you dangerously close to hypothermia. Although hypothermia can occur in any season, the greatest risk is during the winter months, especially if you're not adequately dressed and you're exposed to cold temperatures for a prolonged period of time.
You don't even have to be outside to develop hypothermia. Depending on your age and physical condition, staying in an unheated home during a power outage may put you at risk. Here to give us a thorough understanding of hypothermia is Dr. Chris McStay, Chief of Clinical Operations in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, formerly Chief of Service at the Bellevue Hospital Emergency Department in New York City. He's treated patients who have survived extreme circumstances such as Hurricane Irene and Superstorm Sandy. Welcome to Take Care, Dr. McStay, and thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What exactly is hypothermia, and what are the physical effects on the body?
Hypothermia is defined basically by the body temperature. And as you mentioned, 98.6 is sort of the normal temperature for the body, although that can fluctuate a little bit depending on a variety of factors. Hypothermia is, by definition, a core body temperature of less than 95 degrees Fahrenheit. There's three different sort of broad categories of hypothermia: mild, moderate, and severe. And each of those sort of categories can have their own individual manifestations, which can range from, in mild hypothermia, just sort of mild confusion, some slurred speech, and moderate hypothermia, lethargy, severe confusion, and then in severe hypothermia, complete loss of consciousness, and really those patients can actually can appear dead. So that's in the neurologic manifestations. There are other physiologic parts of the body, your heart, your lung, your kidneys, which can also sort of display issues from hypothermia depending on the level or grade.
If we're talking about mild hypothermia, is that something that someone may go through temporarily and they don't necessarily need to have medical treatment, they just need to be warmed up? Or is it any level of hypothermia needs medical attention?
Sure. So mild hypothermia, just to give you the numbers, is probably between 90 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So as you mentioned, you're 98.6. If you drop 3.6 degrees, you were at 95 degrees Fahrenheit and you are hypothermic. Most of those patients, depending on their age and their sort of baseline physiologic parameters, will be awake and alert, maybe a little confused and obviously cold and obviously typically shivering. Those individuals between 90 to 95 with mild hypothermia typically do well with removal from the cold environment. And remember, one of the big risk factors is being in the cold, but also being in cold water or being cold and wet. So getting those individuals out of those environments, either indoors or out of water into a warm, dry environment, typically those folks will shiver. And shivering is really the main mechanism by which the body generates extra heat to rewarm ourselves. Typically, by getting them out of those environments, getting them into a warm environment, covering them with blankets and allowing that individual to shiver, maybe giving them some warm fluids, they'll usually do just fine. Once you start to get colder, somewhere probably below 82 or 83 degrees Fahrenheit, the body starts to lose its ability to shiver. And so at some point in this continuum of temperature, as you get lower and lower, the body can't effectively quickly rewarm itself by shivering, and if you were to put the patient under warm blankets. So at that point, there are other interventions that need to occur in a hospital setting, which might include adding heat to the body with warm air, warm intravenous fluids, and other things as well.
We want to ask you a little bit later on about how to help somebody that might be suffering from hypothermia if we're not able to get them immediate medical attention. But I wanted to ask this question: how long would it take time-wise for an otherwise healthy middle-aged person who is improperly dressed for cold weather to develop hypothermia if left outside in sub-freezing temperatures. I know there's a whole other set of facts for being in the water, but let's say you were, and we'll go into different situations, your car stalled, it's freezing, it's snowing, you weren't properly dressed, and you're outside. What temperature does it have to be outside for you to start developing a mild form of hypothermia? And what's the time frame here? How long does it take?
Sure. I'll tell you, it's kind of a tough question to answer because it depends on a variety of factors. So I would just say, imagine you're outside and it's 32 degrees, but it's sunny and there's no wind and you're completely dry. Imagine also if you're outside and it's 32 degrees and it's cloudy, it's raining, you're wet, and it's extremely windy. Those factors, including the ambient sunlight that may be put on you, the wind, and your level of wetness, profoundly influence the rate at which someone cools. And of course, the extreme example, as you mentioned, is someone who's immersed in cold water, where the heat transfer from the body into that environment occur very, very quickly. Assuming that someone can stay relatively warm and out of the wind and has appropriate a jacket and warm clothes. And warm clothing, people can stay in very cold environments for many, many hours. Once you start to add in factors like removal of warm clothing, wind, and wetness, then it starts to happen quicker. The body starts to respond to lose heat and to become hypothermic. Also, the individual physiologic factors are important too. The elderly typically do more poorly with losing heat and how their body responds and adapts. And then also children, because they have a larger total body surface area, can lose heat much more quickly as well. So I would say it's a really hard question to answer. To try to put it into perspective, someone who maybe was trapped in a snowbank, who didn't have appropriate clothing and it was very cold and obviously they weren't exposed to sunlight, they could become hypothermic in hours. Someone that was trapped in a car on the roadside obviously would be protected from the wind, and that might not become hypothermic for many, many hours or even days, depending on the temperature. So that's kind of a non-answer to your question, but the important takeaway from that is that staying dry and staying out of the wind, and of course using whatever clothing or protection you have, can profoundly influence how long you might survive and prevent or stave off hypothermia.
So a lot of it has to do with heat loss in the body. In other words, if I get stuck in a car and it's 32 degrees, but it's a sunny day and I have appropriate footwear and I can walk, maybe I have to walk 3 miles. If I'm exerting sufficient, I'm essentially exercising. So that's increasing my body heat, and therefore I'm not losing. It's the idea of the heat loss taking away from core temperature. But if you're moving, you can increase that level.
That's right. So the body both accepts heat and loses heat from the environment, right? A sunny day, you accept heat or receive heat from sunlight. The body also loses heat in a variety of ways. So if you're touching something, imagine touching a cold steel object, you can feel that heat transfer. You lose a fair amount of heat in that way. And air blowing over the body is also another mechanism by which the body loses heat. But the body also generates heat, right? So at baseline, the body generates a certain amount of heat that has to be given off by the body. And you can increase that level or amount of heat that is generated. So the way that we do that as humans, when we are, walking around or outside in cold environments, is we start to exert ourselves a little bit. And we all know that, right? You exert yourself, you create heat within your body and warm yourself. Another mechanism that the body uses is shivering. So when the body does drop to a certain temperature, the body has physiologic mechanisms that tell it to basically shiver. And shivering is essentially just contraction of muscles throughout the body. And that's, almost as if you were walking or exerting yourself, creates a fair amount of heat and is the main mechanism by which the body, especially in people that are really hypothermic and, not awake or don't have the great ability to sort of walk around and to move themselves, that's how the body actually warms itself.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And we are talking with Dr. Chris McStay, Chief of Clinical Operations in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Our topic today is hypothermia. So, Dr. McStay, we're talking about, exertion creating heat in the body. And also, too, you mentioned that, for example, in a car, there's a difference between being in a car and being in a snowbank. If you're in a protected space, you're probably going to do better. So I guess the basic thing, we are living in a climate, basically, that if you get stuck in your car, you probably want to stay put. You probably want to run the engine, see if your cell phone works, not go outside. So if you have a protected space, you're probably better off waiting for help in that protected space, like the interior of a car.
Yeah, that's true. And when you look at survival statistics for search and rescue situations, et cetera, it's often the individuals that stay put, create shelter for themselves, and wait for help that will often do better. You can imagine being lost in the woods, without the best gear. Maybe your footwear isn't sufficient. You can imagine traipsing through the woods, getting lost, exposing your body and your hands and your feet to extremely cold temperature, getting frostbite, and a variety of just really bad things happening to you. Staying in a car, though the car may be cold, it's a very good shelter. In fact, anybody who is lost in the woods, would love to find a car to get into to sleep, because once you're in that environment, you realize that it traps heat, it certainly keeps you out of the wind, and is a good shelter. And for most individuals who are trapped in a car, on a roadside, obviously depending on the outside conditions and, a variety of factors, staying in a car is probably one of the safer places to be, assuming, of course, that the car, isn't in the middle of the road or in a situation where it may be hit by other cars.
Let's talk briefly about some first aid do's and don'ts, because I was actually alarmed when I read that it's dangerous to apply a warm compress to the arms or legs of someone with hypothermia. And I think that if we came across someone that was suffering, it wouldn't be intuitive. You wouldn't know not to do that, but I understand it can be fatal and have dire consequences. Would you explain that?
Sure. So the first thing to do, sort of, from a basic first aid perspective for individuals that are exposed in environments that are cold, is obviously to get them out of that environment as quickly as you can and get them into a warm environment. Often these individuals will have cold or rather wet clothing on them, so their socks, their shoes, whatever clothing they may have. So if they have anything on that is wet, and remember, cotton that is wet is really bad. It loses its insulating capacity. We always say sort of cotton kills. It's one of the maxims of hypothermia and outdoor wear, so to speak. So get them out of that stuff if it is wet. If it's dry, it's probably okay to leave them in it. What you're referring to is one of the concepts, which is it's called after drop, basically. So that if you have someone who's very, very cold, the body typically shunts blood away from the hands and feet and arms and legs and tries to keep warm blood in the core of the body to maintain sort of essential functions of the body, if you will. And some individuals, once you start to rewarm them, that cold blood, which is coming back from your cold arms and legs and that cold tissue, returns to the core of the body and can actually make it a bit more difficult to rewarm individuals. So it's sort of referred to as core after drop. So when we are rewarming patients who are profoundly hypothermic, we say to typically rewarm or place heat or warm objects or rewarm individuals at the core, at the body, and to avoid trying to warm up the arms and legs independently. There's a variety of fluid shifts that occur when the cold blood returns to the core of the body. It's actually kind of complicated physiologically, but one of the sort of chief tenets of rewarming individuals is really to focus on rewarming the core of the body, and that the arms and the legs will eventually be warmed up. Now, that's not to say that if someone's hypothermic, you should avoid covering their arms and legs. I think one of the best ways to rewarm somebody who may be removed from a cold environment, especially sort of in an austere or maybe like camping environment, is to put them into a sleeping bag. Put them into a sleeping bag with another individual, that kind of skin-to-skin contact. I wouldn't say that you should avoid, rewarming arms and legs in that situation, because it's very difficult to do so. But that is sort of one of the concepts of the after drop that we talk about.
I have one follow-up question I'm just curious about. If you found yourself in a situation when you're in a car and you're avoiding the wind and you believe somebody's going to come and get you at least in a matter of hours, but your clothes are wet for some reason, are you actually better off taking off, like wet socks? Let's say you tried to get help, snow went in your boots. Are you better off with that on, because at least it's a layer, or get that wet sock off and put your foot back into the boot?
Sure. So it's a good question. And again, I would reinforce this concept of cotton kills. People who spend a lot of time camping and hiking and skiing, and you know, especially in cold and wet environments, know this, that cotton is a terrible insulator once it becomes wet. That's in contrast to wool and synthetics and other types of fabrics that actually do maintain an element of their insulation capacity when they are wet. So I think it depends. If you know, if you're wearing cotton socks, you know, if you're in your car, you could probably turn on the heater, you know, maybe even dry out your socks to some extent. But if you're really cold and you're in an environment where you know you've got cotton on, you know, I'm not sure that I would necessarily want to take it off, because there is some insulating capacity with cotton as opposed to having your feet or other parts of your body exposed to the bare cold. So I would frankly probably leave them on if you had no choice, because although the insulating capacity is pretty low, it may be adding some benefit in that situation.
All right, then I'm going to offer up one takeaway. I now have a new view on the world. I'm wearing cotton socks, by the way. But I'm going to throw into the back of my car an old wool blanket, because wool will always, even when wet, it'll continue to insulate. Wool socks, and I'll throw in a spare sleeping bag. It sounds like then I could tough it out through most things.
Yeah, and most people would honestly, unless it was profoundly, profoundly cold, and you had risk factors, like you were very old or very young, most people in that circumstance could survive a night, you know, in a car or in a cold environment, and do quite well.
Dr. McStay, we're literally out of time, but I just have to ask you this quick question: does a lot of this apply to pets? I'm curious about dogs. Sorry, I'm an animal lover, and I hate to see people leaving their dogs chained up or letting their outdoor cats out when, you know, where we are, it could be a 20 below wind chill factor. So just very quickly, and you don't have to get into the, but would we apply this? I don't mean about cotton, because my dogs prefer wool, but I mean, as far as body temperature and all that kind of thing, are dogs and cats better able to protect themselves from hypothermia, or are they just as vulnerable as we are?
They're certainly able to withstand colder temperatures. As a cat owner, you know, their fur coat and a variety of factors make them a bit more resilient. With that being said, though, you know, have a heart. When it's cold outside, bring your pets indoors. You know, if you can't bring them indoors, there's a variety of shelters that you can, you know, build or create for animals so that they can stay warm. But yes, you know, animals do succumb to hypothermia, and it can be a real problem and a real killer too. So just think about your pets as you would think about any member of your family in this cold season.
Dr. Christopher McStay is Chief of Clinical Operations for the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, where he is also an associate professor. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.